of the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee. And we have Representative Krupp here. No.
He was.
And we have Representative Minnis here also. What we'll do is we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3629 and call for Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Karen Minnis, representative from House District 20. I appreciate the hearing this testimony, hearing this bill today. This is an issue that was brought before me by the Oregon State Firefighters Association. And we're going to not take a lot of the committee's time to go into this issue. First, I'm going to let Bob Livingston and Nelson Hall, who represents their organization, come up, explain the merits of the bill, and we'll just let the committee take it from there. And I appreciate the committee.
Representative Minister, are there amendments coming to the bill?
Not from my office, but I think there are other people that have amendments for the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
All righty. And there were a number of people signed up to testify on this bill. Also, we have Representative Krupp here to testify, and a number of people who have traveled from out of town to be here to testify on House Bill 2830. So,
I'm done.
You're done?
All right.
Okay.
Do you have any questions?
Any questions for Representative Minnis? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, in order to accommodate Representative Krupp, also in your busy schedule, things you've got to do today, we'll recess the hearing on 3629 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2830.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate the consideration. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is State Representative Jeff Krupp, District 37. You have before you House Bill 2830, and you also should have -4 amendments, which I apologize, we've just received them today, and are essentially asking that the -4 amendments supersede all of the previous amendments to the bill. We have spent considerable time, Representative Mannix and I introduced to this bill. We've spent considerable time in meeting with groups of individuals who have expressed an interest and concerns about various portions of the bill, from Senator Dirksler on the Senate side and the director of Oregon OSHA, Mr. DeLuca, representatives of the unions, representatives of private industry, and numerous other individuals. We have worked diligently to try to meet as many concerns as we felt we possibly could in terms of crafting language and coming up with a bill that we felt would be effective and get the job done that we wanted it to do, and still leave the agency the proper amount of room for them to be able to accomplish what they need to in the form of their proposed Division I rules, which are a result of a great deal of hard work by a great many people. And we recognize that, and we've tried to address that in the amendments here. So we're hoping to move forward with the bill. We're not, of course, asking you to go to a work session today because the -4 amendments are almost what I want them to be, but there is one particular area that I will need to readdress with legislative counsel between now and early next week, that I'd like to do so. So with that, I would entertain any questions and get out of the way and allow public testimony to occur, as I understand we have a great deal of that to occur.
All right, any questions for Representative Krupp?
Yes, I have a couple of questions. Representative Krupp, on -4 amendments on line 16, you're saying this only includes, it says only employers who lost work pay case incident rates at or above the national average classification, are only the ones that can be inspected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, this is a section that specifically deals with, and I know you won't have this in front of you most likely, is the proposed Division I rule changes regarding prioritized inspection scheduling. The agency is proposing three lists, A, B, and C, and this deals with list number C, which has been classified in the document as a random inspection. And I'll read it. List C will be composed of employers in an industry group with a lost workday cases incident rate above the current national average placed in random order. So in that respect, yes, we feel that that language is consistent with what the agency is directing their comments to in list number C of the proposed Division I rules.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and in that same list C, do they also say that those in random selections will get written notice?
No, they do not. Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that is an idea that we felt would be appropriate after talking with numerous individuals, and we felt it would be important for the agency for them to be moving in a direction that they are offering consultative services first as an alternative to inspections of any type is my intention with that. And the offering of consulting services is twofold. The purpose of sending out a notice to an employer would be that they have been, in fact, identified in a high hazard industry group and that they may be inspected. Now, under the current Division I rules, and the agency can talk about this better than I, but from what I read here, in their A and B lists, they're talking about the prioritized scheduling consisting of the top 25% of employers over 11 employees and the top 25% of employers with 10 employees or less. So there are three scheduling lists here, and what I am wanting the agency to do is to notify all of those groups that they include as high hazard in their prioritized scheduling, that they should be notified that they may in fact be inspected so that they still stay on the edge and that they are not getting lackadaisical in any way in regards to worker safety. That's our intention. And our intention also is to offering, the agency would offer their consultative services, which is a program that they have recently, if my memory serves me correct, instituted. I know that my business has participated in that. And it's an excellent concept, and we think that they should be offering that out there as an alternative, as an incentive for businesses to take advantage of the consulting services offered by the agency that ultimately will protect workers before you have an inspection that results in the determination that something is not quite right and someone has been exposed all that time. I think it is much better public policy for the agency to offer consulting services and for employers to feel that that's a proper direction for them to do is to avail themselves of that services from the agency first, before anybody gets hurt, number one, and so that the agency can come out and certify that, yes, this is a safe workplace.
I haven't agreed with you. I think they do great consultative services as well, and I've, availed myself of them as well. But I just want to clearly understand how you envision this working. If the department goes out and sends a notice of their consultative services once a year or once every so often, then can they do random selection or can they do random inspections and of those that are not on the worst first list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, we have left latitude in the wording that LC has drafted here to the extent that's allowed under federal law and under federal regulations, random inspection is meant to be what List C says it should be. The only difference here is that essentially the way we've written this is any group under List C that has a lost workday cases incident rate, we're saying that those that are above the mean national average, which essentially means the top 50% of those people, are the ones that should be inspected. And again, I think that's consistent with where we're going, where the agency is going, where the work group has said they want to go in terms of targeting worst first, the most hazardous. And again, we've left the director lots of language here, lots of latitude for language in regards to where he believes the most unsafe conditions exist. So again, we're crafting this legislation to allow the director the broadest latitude, but yet still provide very firm direction in statute that we want the agency to always consider that the worst first is the direction we need to go into, and that we should try to be more consultative in terms of our direction as opposed to punitive. Punitive, yes, if an industry group or a business such as my own refuses to partake of the offering of consultative services, and we refuse to safely take the steps necessary to produce a safe workplace, then we deserve to be and have every punitive measure that is possible under the law. But we think, and I believe, that the direction of the agency should be, which they are moving, is that we should codify that in statute, the way that we're directing here in this bill.
Just one more, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of the Dash 4 amendments, you say that an inspection may not be unreasonably delayed due to the absence of an attorney or authorized representative. What would you say an unreasonable delay is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I'm going to leave that up to the agency to make that determination by administrative rule as to what they feel an unreasonable delay would be from their part. I'm not going to make that. I'm not going to speak for the agency in that regard. I have felt it is a stretch to go there as it is. And if we're going to do that, then we need to allow, again, the agency the broadest latitude for them to make an appropriate determination by rule.
Further questions from the committee?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your consideration, and I will get out of here.
I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2830 and open a work session on House Bill 3285. And please give us an update on where we were with House Bill 3285 in the last session.
Mr. Chair and committee members, at our May 11th meeting, the committee adopted the Dash 10 amendment, which basically replaced the language in the bill as it was and created a task force to establish, study, and establish a transition of ombudsman programs over to the legislature.
And we admitted that into the bill. Alrighty. And I believe we held this so that members of the committee could consult and make their minds where they wanted to be with it. Sufficient time has elapsed, I hope. And we are in work
today. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Byron.
I move House Bill 3285 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
As you've heard the motion, is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Byron.
I would like to amend my own motion and move the bill to the Committee on Ways and Means, as I see there is an $84,000 fiscal on the bill.
That currently the Dash 10 amendment?
It says the Dash 10s. Just grab me.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move
the bill to the committee on Ways and Means. I think that would be appropriate with the size of the fiscal. Representative Winter, did you wish to comment on that?
Well, I haven't seen the fiscal impact, particularly since the assault legislators who make up the committee.
Staff support and administrative support will be part of the legislative administration legislative assembly budget.
Question to the administrator, who put together the impact? Was that legislative fiscal?
Okay, so the motion for its colleagues to move the House of 2285 to Ways and Means. We do pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so moved. House of 2285 goes to Ways and Means. We do pass recommendation. Okay, and we'll close the work session on House of 2285. And for those of you who have come to testify in House of 2335, as you're aware, we are running behind today, and I don't know that we will get to House of 2335. We will post it again for further work. And we will be scheduling more time for rules committee meetings next week. We'll begin meeting every day or at least three times a week. So. Let's go back to House Bill 3629. And Tom Chamberlain, Portland Firefighters. Outside, yeah. Okay. Is Bob Livingston here? Small. Nelson Hall. I understand this bill was heard. Let's see, this is the hepatitis bill. So. Okay. I gotta go vote. Here's the first page.
Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, appreciate this opportunity to speak in front of you on House Bill 3629. My name is Bob Livingston. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a firefighter here in Salem. To my right, this is Nelson Hall, and to his right is Tom Chamberlain. I'm going to go ahead and start, and then Nelson, I will provide you with some more information, and then I believe that will be followed up by Mr. Chamberlain, if that's okay, the chair.
Okay.
Just a little background to start off with. Hepatitis C and hepatitis in general is a viral illness that affects the liver. In 1990, an antibody to the hepatitis C virus was identified. Before that, the illness was known as non-A, non-B hepatitis. Hepatitis C, or HCV, is the most common chronic bloodborne infection in the United States. Also, infected persons serve as a source of transmission to others and are at risk for chronic liver disease or other HCV-related chronic diseases during the first two or more decades following an infection. Let me just repeat that portion. You can have hepatitis C for more than two or more decades prior to even finding signs and symptoms that you even have the disease. It's a disease that there is no cure for. It's a disease that firefighters, police officers, and correction officers are contracting in their line of duty. I'm briefly just going to throw in a couple other statistics here, and then I'll go into reasons why it's important based on some personal examples that I've been in and that other firefighters and public safety officers have been involved in. Another important factor to remember with hepatitis C and hepatitis B is that, here's another quote, among frequent drug injection users, 50 to 80% are infected with hepatitis C in the first 12 months of beginning illegal drug use. Let me say that again. 50 to 80% of the illegal IV drug users are infected with hepatitis C. Now, the problem that we have is that when, as a firefighter, when these persons unfortunately use a drug such as heroin and they shoot it up into their veins, it has bad consequences. The main consequence that it has is that it generally puts them into respiratory arrest where they don't breathe anymore. We go to these scenes. It's a very uncontrolled environment. Person doesn't know what's going on. You get in there, here's a person that's not breathing. You reach down to get the person to start helping them assist their breathing. Lo and behold, there's a sharp that you didn't see that's underneath the person, because as you roll them over, there's 5 or 6 hypodermic needles. This is a big problem. Inadvertently, you didn't want to be stuck, but you see a person there that's not breathing and he needs assistance. Another example that I can get you, even from a different type of environment, I have had a personal experience where even on a fire call where you're responding to a structure fire, you go into the house, your first priority always is life safety, so you go in, you do your primary search, check for people in the building. Once that, you try to mitigate the damage to the property by putting out the fire. And this one experience that I'm relaying to you is there was a sofa that was on fire. We extinguished the sofa, but as you know, it has foam and it's very difficult to get to the scene of fire in those type of compounding agents. As we're tearing into the sofa to get to the scene of the fire, I noticed that, there's 8 or 9 sharps or needles that somebody's using, obviously for illegal drug use. Fortunately, I was fortunate in that case and I was not stuck with a needle. Unfortunately, there are firefighters that are doing this on a routine basis that haven't been as lucky and have contracted this disease. It is this type of situation, because of an uncontrolled environment and because we are in risky situations where we are exposed to blood on a daily basis, and right now we don't have magic x-ray vision or anything to tell us that, hey, this is infectious blood. Unfortunately, we run into situations where we are running on these people that are in very high-risk categories. And that's the reason why it's very important for us to have some protection in regards to trying to say that this is a job-related illness and it needs some help in regards to why we would need House Bill 3629. One thing that keep in mind, I know there's going to be people that are going to come up here and say they're not at a higher risk, it's going to be too costly. There's a lot of studies that haven't been done. I would just like to mention to you that, one, I can say that I work with firefighters that have this disease. I know there's lots of firefighters in the state that have this disease, and they've gotten it when they're at work. And even if we didn't have a higher rate of incidence to where we're contracting hepatitis C, even to the normal population, one of the things that I would really urge you to really keep in mind and to think about is just, I'll go back and I'll say it again, 50 to 80% of the illegal IV drug users, and this is a quote, I didn't make this up, it's in your testimony that you have in front of you, test positive for hepatitis C. And just ask yourself, what type of people deal with these more than the average person does? And the answer will be, it's going to be your firefighters, police officers, and eventually your correction officers when they do something that get them to be put into a correctional facility. The difference that they have made in contracting the disease is they had a choice. They made a choice to delve into illegal drug use to put them at a higher risk. Unfortunately, firefighters, police officers, and correction officers did not make a choice. What they made a choice to do is to go out and do their jobs to the best of their ability. But unfortunately, once again, we're in a very uncontrolled, dynamic and dangerous environment where these types of situations come up. We try to take as much precaution as we can, but unfortunately, because it is such an uncontrolled environment, it makes it very difficult. And right now, what we're needing from you is we're needing some help in changing how current law looks at when somebody is exposed to these diseases, particularly hepatitis B and Z, excuse me, C. And with that, I would field any questions, or if it's please the chair, I would Nelson Hall could shed some light. He's an attorney and he'll give you a background on where he's coming from, and he'll be able to delve in much better than I can in regards to the legal issues that are involved with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nelson Hall. I'm an attorney, partner in the firm of Bennett, Hartman & Reynolds in Portland. I have, over the years, had the distinct pleasure of representing firefighters, police officers, and corrections officers in the course of my practice. I served for 5 years on the Oregon Workers' Compensation Appeals Board, including 2 years as chair of that board. I have, for 5 winters, taught workers' compensation law, and will again next winter at Northwestern School of Law, Lewis and Clark College, in Portland. Among my clients, I have the privilege of being here today on behalf of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I do not intend to throw statistics at you or get into a debate today about statistics. Rather, what I would like to do is offer one person's perspective, mine, as a practitioner and as an attorney representing individuals covered by this proposed bill. What I want to do is specifically address the heart of this proposed law, and it is the notion of a rebuttable presumption. Currently, the law requires the injured worker, the injured firefighter, police officer, or corrections officer, to carry the burden of establishing that his or her hepatitis B or C was contracted during the course of their employment. And that's a burden no different than with other diseases and injuries in the workers' compensation program. There is one exception historically to that burden, and that has been with firefighters statewide, and they have what is known as the firefighter's presumption for heart disease. We are talking about introducing here a similar presumption for hepatitis B and C. It works this way. If this bill becomes law and a firefighter, police officer, or corrections officer is diagnosed within a certain period of time after they've been on duty for 5 years or more, if they are diagnosed with hepatitis B or C, it will be presumed that their condition was contracted during the course of their employment. It is a rebuttable presumption. The employer is allowed to then come in and establish that, in fact, the firefighter police officer did not contract this during the course of employment. Now, at this point, let me point out, as Mr. Livingston indicated, the most common source of hepatitis C is intravenous drug use. There are other uses, exposures, such as blood transfusion during the surgery, some minor exposures such as tattoos and razor blade cuts and a few other little that they diminished in terms of significance. The most significant is intravenous drug. Well, we don't have to debate the fact that state and municipal police officers and firefighters and corrections officers are not intravenous drug users. So where are they being exposed to this? Now, if it turns out that the employer, and again, this is a rebuttable presumption, the employer can come in and establish, if it turns out that the police officer or the firefighter, in fact, had surgery and received a blood transfusion, and that can be documented in terms of that's the exposure, then that presumption has been overcome. And this is not going to be work-related as well as should not be. But what we do is level the playing field by granting the police officer or the firefighter this presumption. Now, why do I say level the playing field? That's where I think I've been called in to offer testimony today because of my experiences with this. Let me contrast for you very briefly the situation hepatitis B, C versus, let's say, another occupational disease, an exposure to chemicals. And I've worked for an employer, let's say, for 10, 15 years with chemicals. And I am now diagnosed with a lung or blood disease because of this chemical exposure. I can, albeit hard to do, but I can nevertheless go back at the multiple employers, the single employer that I've had, and I can obtain the data sheet, the safety data sheet for the chemicals I've been using. And I can have my doctor come in and try and establish then that my exposure to these chemicals is what caused my condition. Let me contrast that with hepatitis B, C. As Mr. Livingston has indicated, it is a silent killer. I may be diagnosed 15, 20 years after I have been exposed to this as a police officer or a firefighter. and my exposure may have been a needle prick or a cut when I was reaching through the windshield of a broken automobile to pull somebody out of an automobile, and I've cut through those latex gloves, and I now have blood-to-blood contact with the person I'm trying to save. I've now, 15, 20 years in, later been diagnosed. And what am I required to do under current law? I have to go back and reconstruct this. I have to go back and try and identify those occasions where I have been exposed blood-to-blood with somebody that I've been saving. I have to not only reconstruct those incidences, I have to basically get the consent, find those first people, and get their consent, because I need to know their medical status. It may even require some kind of a release from that person to get medical records about their health. Not mine, but that person 15, 10, 15, 20 years ago. I need their consent to get that information. Why? Because present Oregon law requires the injured worker to produce objective, affirmative evidence of this causation. I cannot establish the work connection for my hepatitis C or B by the process of elimination. I can't go in there and say, well, I know I was healthy before. I know my family doesn't have it. I know that I haven't been around any friends with hepatitis C. I can't prove my claim by the process of elimination. I need the affirmative evidence. I need to be able to establish that, in fact, I was exposed to someone with hepatitis C in the course of my employment. I submit, respectfully submit, that that is an impossible, if next to impossible, burden for me to carry. So that's what I mean by leveling the playing field here. It's my burden. I still have to prove that it's work-related, but you are granting me a rebuttable presumption. Come in and we'll presume that it's work-related unless, in fact, it can be established that I had a blood transfusion or tattoos or whatever else, some other source for my hepatitis C and C. I think also, as Mr. Livingston indicated, and I'll quit, we anticipate, you know, the arguments about cost. We anticipate the arguments about that firefighters experience any higher rate of exposure or incidence of hepatitis C than the general population. And there I ask you to stop and think about it. The general population, the police officers and firefighters are being compared to intravenous drug users, primarily. Blood, people who get blood through surgery, transfusions, and so on. That's the general population. So if you eliminate intravenous drug use as a cause among police officers and firefighters, we're really not comparing apples to apples. And I think that's something that we need to be sensitive to. And I am prepared to answer questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chamberlain, do you have something you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Portland Firefighters. And for the last 9 years, I've been an elected trustee of the Portland Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Fund. I am not here today representing the fund. I've not taken a position on this bill. I'm here as a citizen and a representative of the Portland Firefighters. I do propose a friendly amendment, which is House Bill 3629-1. And what this amendment would do would extend the bill not only to all the firefighters in the state of Oregon, but also include those firefighters and police officers in the Portland system. I'd also like to take a moment to speak to the bill. Recently, in the last year, we've tested all the firefighters in the city of Portland for hepatitis C, and we've had 9 that have the disease. What's significant here is what Mr. Hall testified to, is that we have a low-risk group. With, when you look at the statistics, they're at the high end of normal. That in itself is significant. We in the fire service have tried to respond to hepatitis C the best we could. Back in the 80s, when everyone was concerned about AIDS, we started wearing gloves. We started having exposure reports when we were exposed to blood. In fact, recently I moved and I went through one of my records and found an exposure form on myself. Where back then I was a paramedic and I was covered in blood. And the exposure report said one thing: I wasn't exposed to AIDS. didn't mention that I might have been exposed to hepatitis or other things. We weren't looking for the disease back then. In fact, it wasn't until this year that the Portland Fire Bureau established a procedure that requires firefighters to wear eye protection on EMS runs because we didn't know you could contract hepatitis C through your eyes. We're a little behind the curve. I just don't think it's appropriate that we're behind the curve. We're doing the best we can, but those firefighters who didn't know any better, who weren't trained any better, who were exposed to this disease, now are not going to. We need this bill to extend the presumption to them. This is a disease that doesn't have a cure. Liver transplants don't do you any good. They need your help. We ask for your help in passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Meyer.
Thank you. You were talking about the rebuttal presumption, and that's almost impossible to prove by the employee in the current system. If we were to make this change and make the employer prove that it didn't happen that way, isn't it almost also impossible to prove the negative?
Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, the short answer is no. And the reason is you as the employer, you have access to me. I'm your employee. I am available and accessible. You can find out directly from me. Indeed, the law requires me to cooperate fully with you to find out about my health history. So you can find out if I've had blood transfusions recently or years ago. You can find out whether I'm an intravenous drug user or not. You can find out, I suppose, if I've had tattoos recently. So you have me. You have access to me, your employee, to get that information. Whereas as an employee, I've got to go and find a third person. I have to find that victim that I was pulling out of the automobile accident wreck and get his or her consent to see his or her medical records. That's why the disproportionate burden.
Another question?
President Barton.
Thank you. This cases are currently covered under workman's comp.
If the worker can establish the work connection, then yes, it would be covered. That's the but. That's the yes.
Okay. So what this bill is really doing is changing the burden of proof. I mean, that's what it gets down to.
It is.
Okay. If a firefighter, policeman, or corrections officer is denied workman's comp claims in the current law, their health care picked up that coverage, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, that is going to depend on the health care coverage available, and I don't have a ready answer for you, but I can tell you this. If it's not covered by workers' compensation, then there will be the inevitable shift to the private health care or the Blue Cross Kaiser side of the health care ledger or the Oregon Health Plan. So, yes, it will shift to the other side of the insurance ledger.
I don't think there's any police or firemen or corrections officers who qualify for their health plan, but we'll put that aside. So what this really comes down to then is more of a decision of which insurance is going to cover the employee, whether it be health insurance or workman's comp.
Well, no, there are, Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, there are significant differences between the benefits provided under state workers' compensation and that which is provided for under private health insurance. The medical bills may end up getting paid the same, but under the private health insurance, of course, there's no wage loss. There's no loss of permanent disability, any compensation for loss of life or limb, if you will. So, no, the benefits under the two sides of the ledger are not equal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question, Mr. Chamberlain. Could you just describe just briefly what your dash one is doing for the bill?
Dash one,
doesn't understand it.
Basically, it cites the ORS for exempt plans, and that way firefighters and police officers under the Portland plan would get the benefit.
Okay. It just affects the Portland Fire Bureau and police.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. I've got several questions, and depending on whether the chair lets me keep asking. I'll start off at the beginning. I'm curious about the requirement we're going to put in under, on page one of the bill, which is also subject to amendment here, saying that the ordinance or charter for the large city, which I guess so far is still Portland, must provide coverage for hepatitis, whereas we otherwise have said for the entire chapter 656 that they can provide by ordinance or charter compensation equivalent to compensation under this chapter. Then for the first time ever, we bullet this particular item and say, but you've got to cover this. We don't do that for any other condition. Is there a reason why we're doing that here?
It's a pressing problem in Portland. We have 9 firefighters with this bill, with this problem. We anticipate when we test police officers next year, we're going to have a significant increase in the number of hepatitis claims. It's almost impossible, as Mr. Hall stated, to document exposures since we didn't keep track of them in the early 80s.
I think you understood the question, if I may. My point is, we generally said that Portland, by ordinance or charter, will provide its workers' comp system equivalent. And we don't have a whole list of stuff that tells them then how to run the system. But this time we're going to tell them they must include this. Instead of, why don't you just go to Portland and ask them to include the coverage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, to do that would require a ballot charter change. This is a better way to do it.
The entire workers' comp system for the city of Portland is done through charter, and they have to change it by a ballot measure every time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that is correct. To change the city, the authority for our pension comes from Charter 12 of the City of Portland, Charter 5 of the City of Portland. In order to change benefits, whether it's disability benefits or retirement benefits, takes a vote of the people.
Including workers' comp benefits.
Including workers' comp benefits.
Wouldn't you be covered if we changed the substantive part of the law by the substantive change, because then the charter, in effect, grandfathers in the substantive change?
Sir, I'm not an attorney. I can't answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I'll take a stab at it, and that is, I think, to answer your question specifically, this provision is an attempt to make sure that, in other words, it's really consistent with the initial sentence in 6. I appreciate the distinction you're making, equivalent, equal for better 2, where this specifically directs them to accept hepatitis C. If you'll notice on line 28 of the bill, 27 and 28, there's an exception to 027 for sections 802 and following. And as you well know, that's the occupational disease part of the Workers' Compensation Act. So this is a way to make sure that hepatitis C, at least for Portland, doesn't drop through the cracks. Because of the exception to 802. It is, I think, as Mr. Chamberlain was indicating, this is a vehicle. My understanding, Representative Mannix, is that Portland's charter does have the heart presumption in it, but and that was done by amendment to the city charter, and that's why the equal to or better survives with Portland, again, by charter, whereas today is the day we're here. This is the vehicle, and it seems appropriate to take care of that potential crack or fall through the crack at this time.
May I follow up?
Okay.
Do we have any epidemic studies or epidemiological studies that tell us about the incidence of hepatitis C among, say, firefighters, police officers, and corrections officers as opposed to doctors, nurses, dentists, and healthcare providers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, it wasn't until 1990 that we found out that there is actually an antibody, which basically just tells you that this is a new disease, hepatitis C. Before that, it was non-A, non-B. So in my experience, in the research that I've done, there has been no specific studies that have showed whether this is out there. The only thing that I can mention to you is that there are people getting the disease, but I have not seen, and I'm privy to any epidemiological studies that have been partaken for specifically to firefighters or police officers.
I can follow up. See, normally, if we're going to establish a rebuttable presumption or a presumption in the law, we either have some moral absolute that we want to establish and say, hey, we're going to make this, hang on to this, or we do it based on scientific information that tells us, hey, why are we making people prove this over and over again? You know, it's common sense kind of plain on its face. And that's where I'm wondering if after 9 years we have some of that. I would wonder if the Centers for Disease Control would have anything about this, that particular occupation. I don't know what we did when we did the what was called the firefighters presumption years back, but I had assumed that you document exposure to smoke, higher incidence of heart disease and lung disease, and you say, why make them bring this into every case? We'll create that presumption. That's, I'm just inviting this, whether there's any information about that right now.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, to answer that question, one of the problems that we currently are confronted with, other than, as I mentioned before, is with the new disease, is that currently studies and graphs show that there's been a change in the early 90s. There was hepatitis, particularly B and C, were on an increase. We're now seeing where there's a leveling off of that within the normal population, except for two areas. That is, one, there's a huge spike in IV drug users that are contracting hepatitis C, and then there's a slight gradual increase in the healthcare worker. I had contacted the Center of Disease Control, and at this time, whether it's through financial constraints or some other means, they did not have the ability to partake in a study to delve into this issue. And I think one of the things, as it was explained to me when I contacted them, is that because we were asking, and the questions that I was asking of them was narrow in scope, I don't understand how the CDC works. But when you're looking at it for the entire, really, the world is how they work, when you're seeing some decreases in the overall population and only this study affecting a small group of people, the feeling I got from them is that they had other issues to delve into, HIV, some of those other big issues that are global problems and not just isolated to a very small amount of the overall population, if that helps to answer your question at all.
I think we'll hear quite a lot of folks just like to testify on this bill.
Well, I'll just state some further questions without waiting for an answer. One would be, why are we paralleling the 5 years latency time? I could see with lung cancer why there would be latency or heart disease, but why it seems to me you can either document hepatitis C quickly or not. That's one question, why the 5-year latency. Another, why are we mirroring the presumption being hit in with the clear and convincing evidence, which is the highest ever level to rebut that presumption? You're saying we're starting in here and then you've got to get up here. So the burden of proof is virtually impossible on the defense from what I could see. You're basically establishing what I would see as a conclusive presumption here. And we've already brought up the other healthcare personnel and the epidemic studies. And finally, why are we grandfathering in current employees without requiring them to take a test so we could establish a baseline and instead just say, well, they're exempt from it because they may have already had some other condition? Those are all the kinds of questions I'd be asking.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. This bill, we will come back to work this bill, so I appreciate if you could maybe answer those questions in writing or be prepared when this bill comes back to answer those questions.
Be happy, Mr. Chair.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to have Brad Witt, Brian DeLash, and Mary Boxton come forward. And if you could summarize your testimony, we're on a timeline here. We'd appreciate brevity.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Brian DeLash, representing the Oregon Council Police Association. I think you've actually got a pretty good picture from the previous three speakers of what the situation is. And I won't belabor that. Just to indicate our support, the Oregon Council Police Association support for this. the types of situations that police officers get into is very similar to what was described as far as a firefighter. Usually uncontrolled situations where they're intentionally or unintentionally stuck by somebody with a needle. It may in fact be an IV drug user that is using that as a weapon with the intent of either doing immediate bodily harm, or if they do know that they have hepatitis B or C, trying to infect the police officer with B or C by sticking them with a needle. Or it in fact can be in a situation where there's a pat-down or a search in which the police officer could get inadvertently stuck with a needle. So we have on kind of both sides of that spectrum, the intentional and unintentional, and the ability for that police officer obviously to control the situations is somewhat limited. So we have basically the parallel issue as the firefighters have described. We would urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Batson of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I too will be brief. I think the firefighters panel has provided you with all the kind of statistical analysis that you need on this. We have a unique situation in that we represent corrections officers. We have a few police officers are kind of around the state and some of the rural areas. But our main concern at this point is for our corrections folks working in the state prison system. They work in a unique environment where not only are they exposed, but they're exposed on purpose. You know, most of you have heard about the infamous cocktails that the inmates mix up with bodily fluids and keep those in containers so that when the officers are walking the tiers or doing a count or doing a pat down or doing just about anything in a normal course of business, the inmates will throw the cocktail on the officer and purposefully try to infect that officer with some kind of a disease that is incurable. Usually it has to do with HIV. That has always been our biggest fear. Now, of course, we find that our biggest fear should be Hep C. And most recently, we have discovered that it's the splash in the eyes that could be the most lethal. Up till now, we thought it was a blood slug situation, and now we're finding that it has to do with the mucous membrane surrounding the eye, and that is a very serious concern to us now. I know that, I'm sorry, Representative Mannix is gone. We've been working with him very closely. Well, and you too, Mr. Chair, up in Judish on some of the assault bills to include bodily fluids as an assault. And that's a huge issue for us. And it's very hard to go back and redocument dates of exposure and go back and test an inmate that may or may not still be in the system. You know, one of the incidences that comes to mind is an incident that occurred at EOCI in Pendleton where an officer was attacked with a weight bar by an inmate and four officers were injured and there was an immense amount of blood around the area. None of those officers that had kind of peripheral contact were tested. And now, of course, we don't know whether we should have had them tested. Interestingly enough, the inmate later committed suicide. And so now the inmate's gone, literally, and we don't know whether he had Hep C or not. And the officers haven't been tested for Hep C. And you know, I just think this is a whole new exposure issue for us that we've never had to deal with before. And I think that there's a couple of things that we're not taking into consideration or that has not been brought up yet. And that is, there's a whole issue of transfer costs. This is about, not about whether or not somebody's going to get medical care. Our officers are going to get medical care. The question is, for how long and who pays? The officer can receive medical care as long as they're working. But when they stop working, then they have to pay for their own insurance under the COBRA clause. And I know this you know, is no surprise to any of you, they can't afford to continue to do that. Now, if they're suffering from hepatitis C, the treatment option is beta serum. Beta serum costs $1,000 a month. Now, we're talking about continuing your health care, or trying to, continuing to get treatment if they can't continue their health care. And we're talking about who's going to pay for this and who ought to be paying for this. And do we transfer what is legitimately a workers' comp cost onto the private insurance companies and pay for it through private insurance companies and the health plan? Or do we keep it in the system where it has to be so that we can track it, record it, and know what's happening with it so that some of the questions you're asking us today, we can answer it for you? And how long did it take for CDC to even acknowledge that AIDS was a problem? And we're still on the very brink of discovery with Hep C about where it goes and how fast it's communicated and how long it takes to exacerbate. This is a huge issue for us. You know, we're willing to work with the committee to find something that works both for you and for our officers, but we're real committed to trying to get something through that helps both our officers and the rest of the public safety team that we work with in finding a solution for treatment and appropriate treatment and payment and appropriate payment on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Are your officers tested for Hep C right now?
No.
Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I, too, will be very brief. I think you've already received the expert testimony on this bill, and would just share with you anecdotally a conversation that I had with some of our healthcare provider membership just a week and a half ago. I was talking with them about their concerns about exposures to infectious diseases. They, in essence, told me that merely a matter of years ago, the primary concern among healthcare workers was exposure to HIV. Times change, infectious agents change, the things that impact our daily lives change, and they told me virtually unanimously that the major concern that they have today is exposure to hepatitis C. Vastly exceeds their concerns of HIV exposure. This is a particularly virulent disease, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We ought not, as Mary Boston just said, to be involved in cost shifting. We ought to, as a matter of public policy, have workers' compensation coverage for these folks, particularly safety officers who, as you have already heard, are impacted in an uncontrolled environment and who, in virtually a moment's notice, can be infected. This infection not show up for a good many years and then are oftentimes bearing those costs on their own currently. This is a wrong. This is an injustice. These are the folks that are out protecting the public safety and health, and we ought to be equally concerned with their safety and health. We would urge passage of House Bill 3629. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Redd? Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
I'll call Chris Davey, Maria Keltner, Hasina Squires, and Linda Jefferson. Please introduce yourselves to the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I'm pleased to appear before you today on House Bill 3629. Let me first point out that whenever we are discussing proposed workers' compensation legislation, the interest that we have in that is making sure that the system is working fairly for employers and for workers. Also, we want to point out what the consequences are of any legislation that might be proposed and what the potential costs might be. No one disagrees, I think, that the work that firefighters and police officers and corrections officers are doing is dangerous work and difficult work, and that they ought to be protected from the exposures that they have. The bottom line is that they are already protected by the workers' compensation law from their exposure to hepatitis, as this bill addresses. Listening to the testimony of Mr. Livingston, I don't think I have any disagreement with what he said, but there are hazards in that workplace and that they ought to be protected. But in fact, the existing statute already does that. Workers' compensation law is basically divided into sections dealing with injuries and occupational diseases. And it says that if a worker has an on-the-job exposure, and that is the major contributing cause of the disease, and then you can create a medical link between the exposure and the disease, then that disease is compensable. I'm going to use the example of a carpet layer who has bad knees. That person has to show that the employment placed a strain on their knee joints, and then medical evidence must show that the strain from employment is the most contributing cause of the knee condition. That's the same way that all occupational diseases are evaluated. Now, does the legislature need to change the law to provide that protection to the parties requesting this bill? No, but it does not, because there is nothing in the statute today that prevents compensability for these kinds of claims.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
We do have your written testimony here. Could you summarize that for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What this bill would do would be to create a category that is different from any other kind of employment. You have already heard about the presumption, the disputable presumption, and the opportunity of the employer to reverse that. What this bill does actually goes from the point of saying that the employer or the insurer has the burden of providing preponderance of the evidence to saying that they actually have to provide clear and convincing evidence that the employment was not the cause of the condition, and that in fact would be very difficult to do. Another point about this bill is that although the testimony that you've heard relates to hepatitis B and C, in fact the language of the bill does not differentiate between the different kinds of hepatitis. And there are other kinds of hepatitis that are not transmitted through bloodborne transmission in the same way as C might be. I did get some information from the Center for Disease Control. They said that they consider only 1% of hepatitis B cases to be due to employment, only 2% of hepatitis C cases, and that 1.5% of the adult population currently suffers from chronic hepatitis. And in fact, the risk of contracting hepatitis from a needle stick, where the blood is already
infected.
Interrupt your flow, but I need to ask you. You said you were giving statistics about that was contracted through employment. Are you talking about employment in general, or are you talking about employment specific to firefighters and public safety officers?
Actually, the information from CDC was that. This was healthcare related. This was the only kind of employment that was mentioned as a possible cause of the disease, and they categorized it as healthcare.
So, if I'm understanding correctly, you've got a broad range of people included in coming to that conclusion. Some that are in positions where they have a controlled situation that they're working in, versus these folks that we're talking about today who are in situations that are not so controlled, and they're lumped together to come into that. To come up with that statistical information, is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, presumably, yes.
This is Gardner. You mentioned earlier in your testimony that they're already covered, but under the current workers' comp system, some of the testimony earlier said that you could have a needle stick 15 or 20 years ago. 15 or 20 years ago, they didn't necessarily keep records of when an incident like that happened. There wasn't as much heavy concentration on the danger of that kind of exposure, isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that's certainly correct, and the previous testimony correctly pointed out that hepatitis C was only just recently identified as a condition. I guess in looking at this bill and trying to figure out whether there is a problem, there are perhaps three things that you would expect to find if there was a problem that was still needed to be addressed, One would be that you'd have a significant number of hepatitis claims. Then secondly, that a lot of those claims would be denied. And thirdly, there would be evidence supporting a causal relationship of falling short of the statutory standard to establish compensability.
Commissioner Gardner, to be denied, though, if you don't have a record of the actual incident when you were stuck, a reported incident, you would most likely be denied, wouldn't you?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, the point I was going to make is that we have not received, Safe Corporation in the last 3 years has not received any claims from firefighters, police officers, or corrections officers alleging hepatitis exposure or hepatitis condition. So the claims are not out there right now, so that they're not being denied. In fact, according to our records, we have 10 active claims right now for hepatitis. Only one of those claims comes from the group of people who would be covered by this bill. We have 3 claims that are currently in litigation that were denied. None of those came from firefighters, police officers, or corrections officers. We also have a series of claims where we're aware of some exposure or a claim for an exposure to hepatitis, and the claim has been accepted for perhaps something like a knife wound or something like that. Hepatitis has been claimed in those dozen cases. The worker already had hepatitis before the incident, and that was established by a baseline test that was done shortly after the exposure. So I guess just to conclude, Mr. Chair, the fact that there are not that many claims out there suggests that there really is not a problem that needs to be addressed. And I might also add that currently there is a standard, or OSHA standard, that relates to bloodborne pathogens that very clearly spells out for anybody who is working in that area that there is training required about how to protect yourself against those exposures, and if exposed, that there is a protocol that has to be followed in reporting and testing timely. And so as far as current claims are concerned, if those protocols are followed, then there would be an exposure identified. And if the person was found to have the disease, then that claim would be accepted under the current statute.
Thank you. Ms. Squires.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Squires representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and its insurance trust, which is the Special Districts Insurance Services. We represent 800 special districts across the state of Oregon. Approximately 65% of those obtain workers' compensation coverage from our association or our insurance trust. Of the 800 special districts, approximately 300 of those are rural fire protection districts. We don't have anything to do with police, and we don't have anything to do with corrections, only firefighting. I'd just like to express our opposition to this legislation. It really shifts, we see it as a clear shift of burden of proof, and also like to explain to the committee that examining our insurance claims records, we've had more from 1994 to 1999, we have had more workers have more blood exposures other than needle sticks, and I would assume that most of those would come from firefighting or from, we also insure hospital districts in some cases, and the needle sticks do not exceed the number of blood exposures that we have seen. Also like to add too that we have not had one case where hepatitis has been found in any of those employees that we have tested, and that data goes back to 1994, so we've never had a claim for hepatitis. So contrary to some of the testimony that you might have heard with this being a huge issue for some of the employees, it has obviously not been an issue for any of the employees of rural fire protection districts, because we haven't had anyone who's actually tested positive for hepatitis since 1994.
This is Byer. Thank you. Is your insurance group safe?
No, we're a pooled insurance group.
Further questions?
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maria Keltner. I represent the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'm here to express their opposition to House Bill 3629. for the preceding reasons, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, I just note that there will be amendments drafted. Both the proponents and opponents of the meeting, in case you come across the time to talk to you. All righty. Questions, anybody?
Thank you.
We have Linda Jackson. Jefferson.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Simmons. I am Linda Jefferson, a committee member. I'm the Employee Benefits and Workers' Compensation Manager for the City of Portland. I've been in the role of a Workers' Compensation Manager for the past 11 years for the city. And we do have a number of sworn-in personnel, police and fire fighters, who fall under the Oregon Workers' Compensation Program, while the majority of the 700 or 800 plus personnel on the firefighters side are covered under the Fire and Police Pension and Disability Fund for work-related exposures. I'm here this afternoon to express our concern and opposition to the bill. We do feel that the current law appropriately addresses the compensation for any injuries or exposures that may result in a diagnosis of hepatitis C. I would like to say just very briefly that we do value and understand the risks that are associated with public safety officers' work, but we also recognize that there are other public workers who have exposures that are just as great, including our maintenance workers, those that do any type of work in that's associated with maintenance to our parks and all the city facilities truly have exposures to hepatitis C through needle punctures. One of the main concerns is the inequity in establishing a precedence or presumption for one group of individuals that are in one occupation and not giving equal consideration for other occupations that are equally or maybe greater at risk. The city does have one, under the Workers' Compensation Program, one hepatitis C claim that was accepted. In fact, it was the only claim that has been submitted since this diagnosis has been established. We've had numerous claims over the years for needle punctures. Those claims are always accepted. There's generally no diagnosis that results from the exposure. One of the exposures that was not previously mentioned that may result in hepatitis C is an individual sexual activity. And so I think it's important that you have the benefit of knowing that there are numerous sources of exposure for this very serious condition. And Mr. Chamberlain, Tom Chamberlain, who testified earlier, stated that there were 9 officers who have tested positive thus far. These individuals do not include the one firefighter who had filed a claim for workers' comp benefits that was accepted. That preceded the testing. And again, I would like to state that the majority of the City of Portland firefighters and police officers are not subject to Oregon workers' compensation laws. We are, in closing, very much interested in working with the legislature and with the state in establishing some type of policy and procedure for assisting and supporting individuals who have been diagnosed with this condition, whether it be work-related or not. We see that there are some opportunities in that regard and would be very much interested in working, again, in that regard. That's it.
Thank you. My first question has to do with the coverage, and you've alluded to this. Apparently, the City of Portland has its own scheme. Do you have to change the charter every time you want to change coverage?
For workers' compensation benefits, no. We clearly comply with the state statute So there would be no requirement to change the charter or city code for however the benefit program is administered. It's strictly in compliance with state statutes.
Why is there a particular provision in the statute about charters for cities that have a population of over 200,000 and all of that?
In the city's charter?
No, in the state statute, the current statute. Talks about a worker of any city having a population of more than 200,000 that provides by ordinance or charter compensation equivalent to compensation under this chapter except for the provisions of ORS, that's the occupational disease site. It's an exemption from Chapter 656.
Mm-hmm. I would have to say that I'm not familiar with that, and I truly cannot answer.
Couple of follow-ups?
Yes, sir, for a minute.
I'm curious as to whether or not you have any incidence information as to sounds like you don't have many claims either. If you have any information from other jurisdictions or nationally about the incidence of needle sticks or other incidents and the proportion of firefighters or other public safety personnel who may have developed hepatitis C.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, the only information that I have is what was testified to earlier from the Center of Disease Control, that there is a very small percentage, 5% or less, of exposures that or cases that have resulted from occupational exposures.
I'll follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little concern that arises from your testimony, which implied, but I'm getting the drift that maybe you didn't mean to imply it, that firefighters and public safety officers, corrections officers, are that are getting hepatitis C or getting them from sexual activity, IV drug use, cocaine use, shared razors and toothbrushes, testes, and the like. I assume you were just giving overall statistical information rather than any reference to the public safety people involved.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions, Mr. Barr?
Yeah. You can follow up on that. You stated sexual activity, and is hepatitis C actually transmitted through sexual activity? You know that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, from information that I have gleaned from a number of different sources, that is one of the potential exposures to through sexual activity.
Good question. Question Edwards.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little troubled by your testimony regarding the public safety officers are basically exposed at the same level as a park person. Right? Can you elaborate on that? Are you saying that somebody who's not cleaning up a park is more likely to stumble on a needle than somebody who's and therefore exposed to hepatitis C than a public safety officer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, that is, did I say it right?
Okay,
Representative Edwards, I beg your pardon. That is correct. Because there are the dumpsters, the trash containers that are emptied by our public workers do have that exposure, and we have had a number of incidents of discarded hypodermic needles being in the trash and those individuals being stuck by the needle. And I, you know, it could be that that statement is clearly because the greater number of claims that we receive are from other than firefighters and police officers. So there may be a large number, but they're reported under the other program. And I would not have the benefit of that information.
President Edwards, well, I mean, we just heard from the firefighters in Portland that 9 had this disease. They don't, and the testing is supposedly going to happen pretty soon for police officers. I don't know what the magic number is. That seems like a high incident rate, but I don't know. I guess that's a judgment call. Can you testify how many non-public security folks have, other than what we've heard from public safety people, have been exposed to hepatitis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I do not have that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
This will conclude the public hearing on
House Bill 3629, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2830, and at least one individual has driven the ways to be here. Kay King from Florence.
Hi.
Hello, Lynn. The record and take right on.
My name is Kay King, and I'm from Florence. I live on the Oregon coast, and I'm on the very edge as Representative Welch's district. I'm going to entertain you really quickly here because I know you want to see that Blazer game, so I'm not going to make you wait here all evening. I'll try to condense what I have. I think most of you received my testimony via fax this morning. My husband and I have been in business for over 30 years, and during that time, we have seen OSHA and the way that OSHA is implemented change drastically over those 30 years. We used to feel that they were there to be our consultant and our guide and only to be in a Gestapo-type situation when everything else fails. Now we no longer feel that way. We feel that we live in fear of OSHA on a daily basis. In the last year, we have had a very serious accident, and with OSHA's threat over us and also our workers' comp rates, we have thought very seriously about putting 90 people, our employees, out of work because we do not feel any longer that the agencies that are there to protect us and to protect workers are really doing a very good job. If we can't stay in business, folks, we cannot provide jobs for our employees. And so it won't really matter whether we're being safe or not. Safety is at the top of our list. We feel that we've been very good and very compliant through the years, and now we feel that things are a little bit on the extreme side. Several months ago, as you probably already know, OSHA held a group of hearings around the state to find out how we felt about the administrative rules that were up for consideration. It was very clear at that time that the employers around the state were very, very much against the administrative rules that Pete DeLuca and his friends had proposed. Because of that demonstration of our enforced employers around the state, those rules were basically pulled and a committee was formed to come up with a group of rules that may be a little more acceptable to the majority of people. As you know, too, those rules were, they came together, came up with those, presented them to OSHA, and pretty much most of those were also dropped in the garbage can. So here we are today with something that will at least give employers around the state a little bit of relief. We're dealing with OSHA, we're dealing with DEQ, we're dealing with State Lands Division, we're dealing with the Department of DLCD, and we've about had it. Now, there are many states that offer businesses like ours a much more exciting environment to work in than Oregon. And as most of you know, we can't pay more taxes as businesses if we have to be fined, if we have to go through all these steps constantly and spend all of our money on ridiculous things like continuing more OSHA regulations.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner. You said you had an accident a while back. Can you talk a little bit more about what happened?
Yes, we had two men that were injured very seriously in June 25th of 1998. I want you to know that it was May 20th of 1999 before the incident was settled. We received a very unfair citation. We fought that citation. Went to the first level of the hearing, found out that the hearings officer, as you all probably know, works for OSHA, felt that that was very unfair, but to go to the next level, we were advised would cost us at least $25,000 to $35,000 to try to beat it, even though our attorney told us he was quite sure we would be able to beat it at the next level. We felt it was very unfair. We didn't feel we could spend that kind of money on it, and so OSHA won again.
Mr. Chair, you had them seriously injured. How were they injured? What happened?
It was a logging accident.
And they were, are they back to work or are they?
No, they are not.
Are they?
They're alive.
They are alive.
Okay. And they're doing much better. They're both walking. They're both going through training at this time.
They can't return to their profession any longer because of the serious nature of the injury.
That's correct. Okay. I'm not going to read it all to you because you can read it all for yourselves. I just feel that there's an opportunity before you now to make a slight difference in how we do business in Oregon, to help us just a little bit. I don't feel that we need more laws to make OSHA make us safer. We have those laws. We would be very happy to feel that we could work with OSHA on a consulting basis, that we would have an opportunity to correct things before the Gestapo force comes in and threatens us or shuts us down or whatever. We're willing to do that, but at least House Bill 2830 gives us a chance to make the playing field a little more level. If I had my way, we'd take OSHA and we'd revamp the whole thing and make it a safer place for workers, but also allow people that are trying to make a living able to compete. Any other questions?
I'm still in the dark about what it was that happened with OSHA with your injured workers that you so strenuously object to. So could you kind of walk us through what happened to the in that?
In detail? I mean, do you want to know?
I don't want an hour. I just want to understand what your
okay. In the woods. Okay. Okay, thanks. I hold one every day at church. It's hard for me to start. In the woods, it's impossible for every day to be the same. OSHA has a set of regulations that are supposed to apply to every person under every set of circumstances. In the woods, every hillside's different.
Mm-hmm.
Every slope's different. Every turn of logs is different. It can be wet one day. It can be dry one day. This particular case, by the time the OSHA inspectors came to the site on the second day, they already had in their mind that something had happened that did not happen called riding out the chokers. That was nothing that it was occurring at all. When you work with a gravity carriage, if you want me to be specific, and you're moving your cables out to the woods in order to drop them down so that your men can go in and get the chokers and wrap around the logs, because it's gravity controlled, it's impossible for it to land in the exact site you want.
Mm-hmm.
So you have whistles that control that,
mm-hmm.
and because of the steepness of the ground, the amount of time it takes for a whistle to blow, all those things, sometimes you're past the logs. And so you work with whistles and you work those logs, you drop the chokers to the ground, and then you work with whistles to get it back to where that turn of logs is.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes that involves lifting, it's a two-way thing, you lift the lines a little bit and then you pull them toward the logs and lift the lines a little bit and pull them toward the logs. Okay. Once they've gone to the ground the first time, in order to untangle them, the chokers have to have a hold of those lines. Then as the logs go, as they move them up slowly, you're just a matter of feet usually from your turn of logs. And because it's a long thing to explain, but you just about have to hold on to them as you're out to the side while you're moving up to those logs. And once in a while, something can happen. And that's what happened.
And what happened?
The men were lifted off the ground and fell.
Okay, and
much more dangerous than hepatitis C.
And what it is that OSHA did in relationship to this case that you are concerned about that's brought all of this forward?
Well, there were many things that happened during the time. First of all, they interviewed employees without my knowledge after I'd asked to be present at all of the interviews. In the middle of the process, the man who was supposed to be the appeals, not the hearings officer, but the man that was helping us with our case at OSHA,
mm-hmm.
got sick. We'd already gone through the informal hearing. We had to start over again. So the second woman that we had that took over the case had no knowledge of logging, and she was the one trying to impose the fine and make and tell me that she knew how logging worked when she didn't have those skills. They sent me a series of tapes that arrived like 2 days before my informal hearing, and when they arrived, I couldn't understand the tapes because they'd been taped at the wrong speed. And then I was told that it was my job to try to get a tape in time before the informal hearing so that I could be ready for this hearing, or I could postpone it for another 2 months. We went through months of not knowing where OSHA was going with this hearing, and we felt like we were the ones that were being punished. You want me to keep going? Or just when you're done.
This is Gardner. You wanted to be present during all the interviews with the employees. Why?
Mm-hmm. Because it's my right as an employer if the employee does not object.
Did you ask the employees if you could be present?
Yes. When you have a hearing, the investigator goes into the room and asks the employee if it's all right for me to be there. And it was all right, except for the in all the cases, and we had to wait quite a while to see the next employee because he was injured. So then when he was well enough to go, I'm the one that called them and told the investigators that he was able to go to the hearing, you know, that he was well enough to go, and then they went and did the interview without me being present. That's just that isn't why I'm here, but since you asked. By the way, we did everything we could for months to stay as close to those two workers as we could. I mean, they're like our family. These people have worked for us for years. We care very much about their safety. We just didn't appreciate the way it was handled, and I think OSHA has too much power, and 2830 will give us just a little bit of a reprieve in a very small way until we revamp OSHA.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, and thank you for driving over today to be with us.
Thank you.
We do have a number of others on the signed up report today. And we do have the dash 4 minutes before us, however, more amendments are coming. However, everybody else who has signed up appears to be local. Is Joe Miller still here?
Yes.
Are you local here?
Yes.
Okay, so if we were to post this bill up again another time, you'd be able to come back?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's what we'll do.
So we will repost the bill for more work. Hopefully next week we'll make a decision that we'll do it at that time. We are in the public hearing on 2830 is closed, and we are adjourned.
Do you have that?